This is Susan Strait, editor of Dimensions Magazine, and I'm here today with Vinton Cerf, who, along with his colleague Robert E. Kahn, won the U.S. National Medal of Technology for creating and sustaining development of internet protocols and for his continued leadership in this field. They were awarded the Alan M. Turing Award, which is the Nobel Prize of Computer Science, for their work on the internet protocols, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian award in the United States, and countless other honors. Since 2005, he has served as Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist for Google. One of his latest projects is co-founding the People-Centered Internet, PCI, which is dedicated to working for an internet that works for people. Vint, you recently recovered from COVID-19. We are so glad you are feeling better. Can you tell us about how that experience and the current global crisis are influencing what you want to work on next?
Well, thank you. By the way, I really am glad to be back to whatever is normal these days. I mean, in the midst of a pandemic, I suspect new normal is not quite the same as the normal we have all become accustomed to. This was an interesting experience because the symptoms were actually mild and they were textbook. In other words, I got a headache, I got a fever, 102.4, then I had chills, and then I was just exhausted. So your body fights this virus and it consumes a lot of energy in the process. So it took about, I would say, 3 weeks to get back to a kind of an energy level that I would consider close to normal. The thing which I found the most alarming, of course, is you don't know what the progress of the disease is going to be. You're reading about the more severe cases. You read about people who end up in ICUs and then they end up on ventilators. And some of them die. And you don't know what path you're on. You don't know whether your symptoms are going to get worse. So in some ways, the stress of the disease is almost as bad as the disease, at least psychologically speaking. By good fortune, one of our younger son flew in from Los Angeles for 3 weeks, bless his heart, to do cooking and food shopping and the like. So my wife and I, who both tested positive for COVID-19, did not have to leave the house. So we were well cared for. We also discovered that the healthcare system is broken in a number of different ways, unexpectedly so. For example, we had to fight very hard to get tested. It was clear that I had the symptoms, and I was unable to get tested in the state of Virginia. We live in Fairfax County, and the nearest test center at the time was in an adjacent county, and they said, "Well, you don't live here, so we won't test you." We couldn't get the local Fairfax County health department to do any testing because they said they didn't have adequate protective equipment to do so. And so we ended up paying $500 each to go to a facility in Washington, D.C. to be tested. And we got back the positive reading. So that's one point. The second point is that some of the doctors that we consulted refused to see us in person. They said, "Well, we'll be happy to do video consults." And I'm sitting here saying, but you need to take a swab. You can't tell what I have and what I don't have without actually getting samples. And they just adamantly refused. So those little experiences, plus everything you see in the news, tells you that our healthcare system is not adequate, not adequately resilient and not equipped to deal with something like this. And that, frankly, is pretty scary. Mm-hmm.
So switching courses a little bit, just over a year ago on December 10th, 2018, we reached the milestone of roughly half the world's population having access to the internet. That's nearly 30 years since the internet was made publicly available. What kind of global progress do you see to connect the other 50%?
So this is a topic of great interest to me. We often refer to this as digital inclusion. And it's my view that there are a number of barriers that are getting in the way of making it possible for everyone to get access to the internet. Not everyone wants access to the internet. I think it's important to recognize that. And there are a number of reasons for that. But I think no one should be bereft of the opportunity to choose to have access. And I do believe that if you have access and it is denied to you by a nation state or something, that that's a violation of human rights because you should have access to the technology in order to express yourself and to hear what other people have to say. It's freedom of access to information, freedom of speech and the like. So what's to be done? Well, the first problem is often physical facilities are just not there. The underlying transport, whether it's radio-based like Wi-Fi or LTE or mobile phone or hardwired, cable systems or fiber, that those physical facilities may simply not be there. Or if they are there, they might be too expensive and so not affordable. Or it may be that the equipment's been installed, but then a business model hasn't been established that's sustainable, and so the facility goes away. But then it gets more complicated, even when you do have access. The question is, do you have suitable equipment? Do you have access to content in the language that you understand? Is the information that is available to you useful locally? Because, if you're in Colombia and you're asking for a plumber and we tell you that here's a plumber in New York City, that doesn't help you very much. So there are a variety of desiderata that need to be in place to make internet access useful. Then there's digital literacy, and this gets to this unfortunate fact that the online environment is not necessarily safe. There are lots of technical challenges associated with malware, people attacking various servers or attacking your machine. Or there are people who are trying to mislead you with information that to get you to do something you might not want to do. Phishing attacks that invite you to respond to an email or click on some link page that ends up in identity theft or access to accounts that you would not normally allow a third party to have access to. So there are a variety of risk factors associated with being online. And as much as I would like to mitigate those, people need to be aware of them so as to protect themselves. I haven't even begun on the topic of identification, strong authentication of identity. The ability to resist other people pretending to be you and taking actions on your behalf. So it's a mixed bag to get the other half of the world online and to get the half that is online into a safer position than it's in right now. So that effort continues on many different fronts. The People-Centered Internet is one of many organizations. The Marconi Society recently started an effort on digital inclusion with similar objectives. So there's a lot of work still to be done.
With schools and universities closed in response to COVID-19, America's digital divide is all too apparent. What should be done here in the United States to address the inequity in access to the internet and digital technologies?
Well, some of the problems that I related earlier are relevant to the U.S. Sometimes cost is an issue, sustainability is an issue, available physical facilities is an issue. We have not done well in terms of policy. When it comes to bringing the rural parts of the country online, it's often expensive to provide broadband access in areas that have low population density. Stringing fiber is expensive, for example, or digging trenches. Some of those problems can be dealt with using high-speed radio and even free space lasers as backbone components, because they're less expensive than trenching for fiber. There is a major initiative whose outcome is still uncertain, and that's to put low Earth orbiting satellites in place. Some of you, your listeners, will know about the Starlink program that Elon Musk initiated through SpaceX. But there are others. Sadly, one of them just went bankrupt. It was called OneWeb. But the idea here is to put thousands of low Earth orbiting satellites in place to provide high bandwidth and low latency access to the internet virtually from every square inch of the planet. Whether that turns out to be economically attractive for people who are on the lower end of the economic spectrum remains to be seen, but at least it's an initiative that should provide more access than there is today in areas that are not served adequately or not served at all.
And what does it matter? Why does it matter that people have access to the internet, and is access enough?
Well, access is not enough. Just to take the last point, I mean, you have all the other things that I mentioned earlier about digital literacy and about access to useful information in languages that you understand. I think that the experience of the pandemic illustrates at least two things. One of them is that we have been able to adapt our daily lives to a more online environment, which I think is pretty amazing when you think about the load that's being placed on the internet from schools and universities, people in business asking their employees to work from home, video conferences or audio conferences like the ones we're in right now are demanding capacity that's symmetric. That is, especially if it's video conferencing, you have to be able to push video as well as receive it. While the most popular video applications of the pre-pandemic period tended to be downloading a video, watching Netflix movies, or other kinds of video formats. So I think we've discovered that it's possible to do a lot of work online. And I think that may have a more permanent effect on our post-pandemic future as companies think about how they would respond to this in, again, if this happens again, which it probably will, or how to work this notion into a normal work pattern where working from home is considered acceptable for some periods of time, regardless of pandemic, simply for the convenience of employees. So I think that we're exploring a pretty interesting territory now where the internet plays an even more prominent role in our daily activities than it has in the past.
Mm-hmm. So in response to public health guidance related to COVID-19, essentially all of our science and technology centers and museums and cultural institutions generally are temporarily closed to the public. Many museums have found ingenious and creative ways to provide online science learning and engagement. And I'm wondering, what are some innovative approaches you've seen or hope to see using the internet to engage people in science?
Well, let me pick arts for just a second, because there is a Google Arts and Culture activity which has made a practice of high-resolution imaging in many museums and galleries. The thing that's exciting to me, of course, is the possibility of using digital technology to get deeper into a subject, whether it's learning more about painting or learning more about a scientific process or scientific discovery. One thing that we know is that computers have become increasingly important in scientific research, whether it's modeling or big data analysis planning of experiments. Computing has become pretty important. And so you hear phrases like computational biology, computational astrology, computational physics, where supercomputers or high capacity computing capabilities used to help science make progress. So one is struck immediately by the idea that a pandemic or not, computing is becoming an increasingly valuable part of the scientific enterprise. And in many cases, you can do that from virtually anywhere. So I'm actually rather excited about the fact that, that we're bringing more and more computing power to bear in aid of scientific research. And of course, this extends now into the use of machine learning. Some people refer to this as artificial intelligence, but at Google, we want to make a distinction between general artificial intelligence, which is what we think of as human capabilities, and machine learning, which are machine capabilities that allow it to do things at scale, at a scale that we can't as humans, but doesn't necessarily meet the normal criteria for general intelligence, but it does allow for pattern matching or pattern recognition, pattern discovery, which is quite important. So just to give an illustration of this, one of our engineers at Google was working on the data that had been accumulated to try to find planets around distant stars by observing the dimming of the light in the that the star emitted. And it turns out, of course, that there's a massive amount of data, and figuring out that a particular star has a pattern to dimming is a non-trivial exercise. And this employee used machine learning methods to detect a pattern, which essentially identified a planet that had not been discovered by other astronomers. And so this simply illustrates for me that our tools are increasingly helpful in the act of discovery in addition to analysis or simulation. And I consider that to be pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. Our museum members strive to develop accessible science engagement opportunities, both hands-on and online. And your own hearing loss and that of your wife, Sigrid, led you to advocate for accessibility in technology development and product design. What reflections do you have on accessible design that our member museums might learn from?
Well, thank you for asking that. Yeah, this is a hard problem. In my case, my hearing began to be visibly diminished when I was about 13. So I started wearing hearing aids. At that point, my wife had a different experience. Oh, and my hearing kind of goes down by 1 dB a year, but the hearing aids get better. So I've been functional as I am at the moment. I'm wearing 2 hearing aids and we're having a conversation. My wife's case was somewhat different. She had normal hearing until she was 3 and then dramatically lost all of it and became profoundly deaf because of spinal meningitis. So she spent 50 years lip reading. She didn't learn to sign. She had to face people in order to figure out what they were saying. And I can tell you that is an exhausting process. Then she got a cochlear implant at age 53 from Johns Hopkins in 1996. And this was absolutely life-changing. She was able to hear, use the phone, watch television, go to the movies, have parties with more than 3 people. We even had to get a bigger house because she wanted bigger parties instead of downsizing, which is what everybody else is doing. And she then got a second cochlear implant. So she's now binaural with cochlear implant technology. And in the most recent years, we've seen significant brain plasticity and improvement in the quality of her hearing and her acuity. However, during that 50-year period when she could not hear, I was strongly motivated to encourage her to use computers for communication. And I wanted her to use email, for example, and to make use of the internet. And it's odd in a way that she was resistant to this because she's an artist, she's not a technologist. The internet was slow in its early days, and she was impatient. And so it was her book club members who managed to get her to use email because they couldn't call her on the phone. And now, of course, with the high-speed internet that's available and the elaboration of content in the World Wide Web and tools like Google Search, she's online all the time and making very heavy use of the internet's contents in addition to its ability to facilitate communication, video conferencing, sharing of pictures, watching the grandchildren grow up in San Francisco, and so on. So she's become very much a part of the internet world.
And last question, what's your favorite science and technology center or museum?
Oh, that's really hard because there are so many of them and they have varying characteristics. But I will confess to you, I'm a little bit biased just at the moment. My wife and I spent 3 weeks, one in January, one in February, one in March, in London, living across the street from the British Museum. And so convenient access to that institution was simply mind-boggling. And of course, we didn't see more than just a small part of it. We live in the Washington, D.C. area, and so the Smithsonian institutions are all remarkable, including the most recent one, the African American Museum. I confess to you that the one that I like the most is the Museum of Natural History, and then it's a toss-up between the National Air and Space Museum and the Museum of American History, where I've had a small role trying to help organize some of the exhibits. So for me, the Smithsonian institutions And the British Museum are very high on my list of favorite places to go.
Finch, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for making the time.
Well, it's always fun to talk about oneself, so I appreciate the opportunity. And I certainly look forward to learning more about your activities as time goes on.
We'd be delighted.